This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
It's 12 o'clock and it's a wonderful day. I know.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another issue, edition, episode even, of the Sellers Points podcast. Since we talk about comics, we clearly have issues, and I do too, because I can't seem to keep my stuff straight. But that's what happens whenever you take an extended break and you have to try and get back to doing this. And anyway, I'm Russell Sellers, and joining me, as he always does on this journey into insanity, is Mr. Kelly Poole. How's it going, Kelly?
Oh, good.
Kelly's doing good. No dumpster fires today?
Not today, no.
Not yet? All right.
No, not yet.
Well, we'll try to avoid setting any of them on fire, but you never know, we might. It's a thing with us. It's a thing with Kelly. He likes to set dumpsters on fire. But in any case, this episode, we're going to be talking to you guys, as we tend to do from time to time, about some current events. The comic book world is typically full of event happenings from, you know, DC, Marvel. They tend to be the guilty parties associated with making us buy tons and tons of books that are sometimes unnecessary. But we're not here to talk about metal. We do that on a pod blast with me and Todd Weber, which you guys can go and check out. The one we just did about issue 4 not that long ago. But for now, we're going to be talking about a couple of other events that have been happening in DC Comics and some happenings over at Marvel, which is Kelly's favorite subject, so I thought we'd start there. And Marvel Comics is undergoing a bit of a change now. They've gotten rid of some of the top brass. Some longtime folks are leaving, both in the creative side and in the executive side of things. And I guess before we get started, we should. I wanted us to send some well wishes out there to a Place to Be Nation stalwart, if you will, a guy who's actually been on this show once or twice, Mr. Ben Morse, who is in fact or who has actually left his position at Marvel Comics for a new teaching gig out in sunny Las Vegas. And I think from me and Kelly, we both wanted to say we very much appreciated having Ben on the show the times that he came on. Would hope to be able to get him back sometime in the future, though he's going to be a busy guy shaping the young minds of the future. And we wish him all the best. He did a lot of really great work over at Marvel, handling their like digital media side. He and the guys did amazing work with the Marvel Unlimited app, the Webby award-winning Marvel Unlimited app, we should say. So, all the well wishes of the Sellers Points podcast to Ben and everything that he does in the future. But aside from that, we also know that Brian Bendis has now officially left Marvel Comics, and as of just, I believe it was this past week, had his first official day as an exclusive writer for DC Comics. But on his way out the door, we're going to get into some Spider-Man 2 spoiler territory here. Bendis seems to have reestablished something that we all kind of thought was lost to the annals of Marvel history, a casualty of the recent Secret Wars event, the Ultimate Universe. It now appears as if it is reestablished. And We don't know really what that means or what the full scope of that means as of yet. Of course, we know that certain characters in the main Marvel U at the moment are refugees from the Ultimate Universe, specifically Miles Morales. The Spider-Man of the Ultimate Universe has been in the main 616 Earth, if you will. And that was because his home was seemingly destroyed, but now it seems his home is back. So what could that mean for the future of him? We don't honestly know.
Make up your mind.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know what this means yet. The ending of Spider-Man 2 does seem to suggest that even Miles himself is contemplating what his future as Spider-Man could or even should be. Kind of seems that it's all up in the air, and the next creators or the next people to handle the character are going to have to make up their minds on that one. So I guess Marvel has just been, you know, they've been given an opportunity with the character. Bendis set them up in a different kind of way and said, look, here, you can take this character and you can do with him what you will. You can keep him as a Spider-Man, or you can not have him be a legacy character. You can give him a different code name if you want. Or you can just not use the character at all, or maybe send him back to the Ultimate Universe. Kelly, what do you think they should do with Miles now that Bendis will no longer be writing him?
So basically, make sure I'm on the same page. Is we have the 616 universe, and then we have the Ultimate Universe.
Yep,
and they're separate. And Miles is where? On 616, or is he back on?
No, he's not on the Ultimate Earth. He's on 616 still, but with the reestablishment of the Ultimate Universe being in existence, I guess that's an option. If they wanted, they could send him back there and have him be the Spider-Man of that Earth, as he was before.
I'd say, you know, if that universe doesn't have a Spider-Man, then yeah, you know, let him get back home. I mean, that's where he comes from. That's, you know, I guess the only thing that would suck is that he'd leave. I don't know. Is the Champions, is it getting canceled or is it still going?
I would say that the smart money is on Champions not making it much longer. Because of the whole, like, the Avengers No Surrender crossover, I think, does encompass that book as well.
Yeah.
And or at least its writer, Mark Waid, is a big part of that book. So,
mm-hmm.
And it does feel like, and I'm reasonably sure that No Surrender, which is a weekly event book for them, is going to result in there being like a streamlined, maybe one Avengers title. Champions probably won't make it out. And I also think that Mark Waid will not be writing Avengers anymore past that. So this is like the big last hurrah event, you know, like,
yeah,
here's where we write our ending, and we leave it open for the next creative team to come in and do their thing. That hasn't been announced. We don't know that yet. So we're all just kind of in wait and see mode.
Yeah.
But I would anticipate that Champions probably won't be around much longer. And honestly, some streamlining does need to happen. And I kind of feel that way about DC as well. Like, there are lots and lots of teams. Let's get it kind of reined in. Let's right-size this ship, if we will, if you will. So we'll see what happens to Champions, but if I were to put money on it, I'd say that it's not going to make it.
Well, I mean, I did read that for a while, and it was one of the books I thought had potential, even though I wasn't really liking Waid's writing on the book too much. I mean, it, I don't know, but I enjoyed the characters, and I enjoyed, you know, the fact that Champions was still kind of a thing. But I didn't see it going very long, and so I agree with it. It probably is on the cutting block, but which is unfortunate because the team dynamic and the group that they had set up was really cool. So
yeah,
again, the whole thing with like the Young Avengers, the champions now, these would be like the Teen Titans of Marvel if they would just stick and give these young characters a team book, you know. Mm-hmm. But
that is something that, you know, I do wish that they could that Marvel would focus on a little bit more, is like giving them a Teen Titans level book, which yep. at one time was Uncanny X-Men. Because you had these younger heroes who were, you know,
yeah.
teenagers doing their thing, which that was like way back in the 70s, 80s. But of course, as they've aged, gotten older, things have changed. But in any case, I'm kind of excited about the idea of the Ultimate Universe being back and the possibilities for that going forward, especially since, you know, some of Bendis's other creations might not be, you know, used or utilized in quite the same way that they were while he was a part of Marvel. Now mm-hmm. now that he's going to be leaving, they may not be as like gung ho about pushing his characters, like his creations anyway, out front, which is unfortunate because he's got a lot of good ones. But if you were going to establish an Ultimate Universe line again, that could be a way of kind of keeping those characters alive and fresh for people. And I would hope they wouldn't abandon all of them completely, because some of them have, you know, staked out a really important part, or really important parts of the Marvel U, like Jessica Jones, for example. Really great show on Netflix. I think people have truly become big fans of her. I think she's got a strong and loyal fan base. And luckily, we know that that the Jessica Jones comic is going to continue post-Bendis. He's writing an ending for it, but it sets up the next chapter for them, for the new creative team to come in and do something. We don't know who that new creative team is yet, but we do know that that a team has been chosen. They're just waiting to announce it. So I'm glad that book is continuing, but on the flip side of things, as we were talking about books ending, quite a few Marvel comics have been hit with cancellation recently. Some of those were expected, and at least one of those I found very surprising. So, Kelly, I know you probably giggled to yourself a little bit about some of these cancellations.
Well, I mean, you know, seeing like America get canceled, and some of the books. Yeah, I mean it was writing on the wall. I mean it's been like that for a year or so. I mean, they weren't very good. They weren't well written. America gets all this praise, but I don't see what for. And I read the book for four issues, and I mean I gave it. And you know me, Russell. I give things a pretty fair shot, and four issues to me was enough. And just using that book as an example, I mean, the character had, I mean, it's like the person that was writing it didn't give any crap about the history of the character or anything. They just wanted to focus on the lesbian part of it and the wackiness that they were trying to ensue with that book. And, you know, this is my point about a character's sexuality. That's only a facet of their personality. It's not who they are. And I think a lot of times these companies, they want to write a gay character, they want to write a lesbian character, they want to do a trans character, and that's all well and good. But that's not the only thing in a person's life. You know, it's an aspect of them. And that's fine to delve into it, to talk about it, but just to, it's like Iceman, you know, that was, Cena Grace wrote Iceman like a 90s gay, you know, sitcom character from the 90s, and just nothing like what a gay person would act like. And just, you know, it's just bad. It's just bad all around, so...
And superheroes are not certain people's forte when it comes to their writing. Because Cena Grace has written some stuff that's very good. And it's not superhero work, but it's like his little depressed boy comic. Mm-hmm.
I've heard that's good. Yeah, I haven't read it, but I've, you know.
Yeah, it is like the stuff that I've read of it. I thought this was done really well. This for what it is, of course, and since it's not superheroes, it's a very different style story. And yeah. I felt like, okay, this is him in his element. This is him like really at peak game. So yeah, he is a talented writer, absolutely. But not every talented writer is meant for superheroes. Even should be. Like sometimes whenever you're writing an indie comic or you're writing your own thing, that's what you're best at and that's where you're going to get the best results.
I think it was poor choosing for who they got to write America and who they got to write Iceman. I think if you're gonna hire someone to write a superhero book, at least have some appreciation for the medium you're about to write in. And I don't think either one of them really had much, you know, care about the content that they were writing or the characters and the history that those characters had. So, you know,
it can be a tough thing when you're trying to do your own take on certain characters, and I can understand kind of where the frustration comes from and where the want and need to try and push things forward and do something that has never been done before, or at least to try and view these characters in a different way, a different light. And some of it worked, some of it didn't, but none of it translated into sales. And the truth of the matter is, speaking mostly for solo X-Men character books, outside of Wolverine, none of them have ever really caught on. It's kind of a tough sell, really, getting taking these characters who are traditionally team book characters and turning them into solo characters. Now, certain ones of them have popularity, sure, but that's never translated into what I would say is big enough sales to justify keeping them around.
Right. It is difficult to, you know, if you're going to do, and really what Marvel just has, what they should do is stop with the ongoing series. And if you want to do a story about Nightcrawler, or you want to do a story about Scarlet Witch or Quicksilver or whoever, just do it in a 6-issue miniseries, or do it in a 12 issue. Say we're gonna do a year long series, one in 12. We're gonna be done with it, and go that way. Because you're absolutely right. Outside of Wolverine, there's no X character that can carry their own book, unless you have a AAA team working on that book. If you had Geoff Johns decided he wanted to write Nightcrawler, I had a pretty good bet that Nightcrawler would be a pretty good damn book then.
Yeah.
But you're not going to get these big A-star writers and artists to come in and do these books. Maybe for a miniseries, but not ongoing, because they're not going to want to write about Nightcrawler, as great as he is, or whoever, you know. Yeah. It just...
I could see, the miniseries idea, I think, is a good one, because... it allows some of your younger and newer talent a chance to come in and tell stories with these characters. And if they can turn it into, you know, a critical or a commercial hit, then, hey, maybe you've got something here. Maybe you've got somebody who is, you know, going to break out for you and possibly be your next big star. And that's another reason that I think Bendis leaving Marvel could be a great thing for a lot of the younger talent, the ones who are trying to come up and get those big books and get that big work. Because, you know, when you've got a big talent like Bendis in the room, he takes up a lot of room. And I don't mean that because he was at one time fat. He's very skinny now. I meant that a presence like his looms large, just like Geoff Johns, if he's at, you know, DC and he's kind of steering the ship, or he's an option for writing a book, his presence looms large. It's hard for some of the younger talent to get seen, to get noticed. So this is a big opportunity over at Marvel for a lot of these younger talents to step up and really make something new. So I, for one, am very hopeful that somebody's going to break out from this.
Like, yeah.
Somebody over at Marvel is going to have a breakout career, or that breakout book where they're going to be like, all right, this is our new guy or girl or like whoever. This is going to be our new thing. And you know, we'd never know where it's going to come from. And right now I am kind of watching what's going on over with the X-Men books, mostly because of the cancellations, but also because now Disney has bought up the Fox movie studio, which includes the film rights to the X-Men characters. So I would think that this means a renewed interest in publishing something or getting the X-Men characters back to prominence. So I'm kind of on the lookout for something big to happen there. I don't know what yet, but you know, it kind of feels like we're moving towards something big.
Yeah.
And we'll see. I'm curious about this this X-Men Red book that's coming out from Tom Taylor. Pretty good lineup there, led by the now resurrected Jean Grey. And he announced just recently that Gambit is joining the lineup. So there's another A-lister jumping in. You put Rogue in there, and I think that you've got a recipe for a tremendous book. This is also where Laura, the current all-new Wolverine, X-23 as some people know her, she will be in that book. So there's a lot coming up there in Marvel that could be something really interesting for us to keep an eye on. And you know, it's all leading up, I think, to Kelly's grand return to the Marvel Comics side of the house.
Well, I mean, it's like we were talking about earlier, I'm intrigued by the new Exile listing for the new Exile book, because I was a huge fan of that. I had a lot of friends that I got in I got them into that book because they wanted something a little different, but they loved the X-Men, but they were tired of kind of the same old, same old. I was like, look, this is Quantum Leap with the X-Men. You know, this is Sliders with the X-Men. I mean, they're going from one different Earth to another, fixing things, and kind of you're gonna see all of these really weird kind of. It's like traveling in the What If universe, and I'm intrigued by that. I'd love to see that them kind of return and recapture that magic. And I'd love to pick up another Marvel book at this point in time and just have something to read that's good. And so. Yeah, I mean, I'm sad that some of these books have been canceled, but you know, there's the other fact that it's been a long time coming. I mean, it comes down to, like you said, the bottom line. It's got to meet sales. You've got to sell, and if it doesn't sell, then it's going to get dropped.
And it's only one of the books that was canceled really shocked me, and that was Luke Cage, but. David Walker, who's been on that book for 16 issues. I mean, yes, 16 issues this book survived and is now being canceled. It's kind of an odd thing. But he was very candid about why it was being canceled, and it was due to poor sales.
Yeah.
And like this, I mean, it's a harsh reality that comes down sometimes, especially since what I've read of the Luke Cage book has actually been pretty good. I mean, it's not like the most amazing book ever, but it was certainly a pretty strong title. And in the Defenders lineup of books, that being Daredevil, Iron Fist, Jessica Jones, and Luke Cage, as well as their team-up book, The Defenders, all of these titles have actually been very good. I've been reading Jessica Jones, Defenders, and I've finally started catching up on Charles Soule's Daredevil. I got to give the guy a lot of credit. This is yet another Daredevil run that I am very much enjoying. So I've got nothing but good things to say about that side of the Marvel house, and it's really disappointing to me that that Luke Cage is being hit with a cancellation.
Yeah.
It's disappointing to me that more people aren't supporting that book. I say, as I sit here waiting for it to hit Marvel Unlimited, like I can say anything. But this is, it's a harsh reality, and it's one that I think is incredibly unfortunate for this title. And I really hope that Luke Cage isn't going anywhere as a character. I mean, he's still a very big part of Defenders. He's a big part of the Jessica Jones solo title. So we're going to see him more. I feel like he's going to be showing up, of course, in Iron Fist, because he and Danny Rand are, you know, kind of intertwined with each other. But it sucks that when he gets his solo book, it doesn't do better than this.
So, yeah.
But that's where we are. And like we were saying before, it's the reality of the situation. This is a business, and if you don't get the sales numbers, your book's not going to make it.
This is
where we are. But but moving on from that, from the kind of negative downside news, let's talk about some positive news. This, of course, being our current events episode, we are going to be talking about a couple of big DC Comics events. Not Metal. There are two others. And the first one would be the Super Sons of Tomorrow, which is a crossover that's been happening in the Super Sons book along with the Teen Titans and Superman. Hasn't concluded yet as of this recording, but we're only one issue away from that story reaching its end. And for a little background, of course, folks, it's the story that kind of picks up from some events that happened over in Detective Comics and a story arc called A Lonely Place of Living, which saw Tim Drake return seemingly, or at least sort of, from the dead. He was actually, as most know, held prisoner by the mysterious Mr. Oz, who turned out to be Jor-El, the biological father of Superman. And in one of the other cells in Mr. Oz's prison was another Tim Drake, a future Tim Drake, who in his version of the future had gone on to become Batman, and a kind of murderous Batman at that. And at first it didn't really make a lot of sense why Mr. Oz would keep him hidden away. Like, why would he take this time traveling Batman and put him in a time displaced prison? Well, as it turns out, Tim Drake came back in time to try and prevent a lot of the future that he comes from, where millions of people had died as a result of John Kent, the Superboy of this Earth, losing control and unleashing his solar flare ability, which is something that he and his father both have. That's an extension of their heat vision. It's like a mini nuclear blast that they like store. Like, it takes all the solar energy stored up in their body and unleashes it all at once. And apparently at some point in the future, John unleashes and kills like millions of people. So here's a time travel Tim Drake coming back in time to try and prevent this from happening. His mission is to kill John Kent. And of course, this is not going to go over well with Batman, with Superman, or with the Teen Titans, and especially not Damian Wayne. So big conflict happening between these teams. But of course, when Tim, the future Tim, reveals what has happened to the Teen Titans and to Damian John himself, some of them are a little taken aback, like, huh, you know, they don't agree with killing John, but they're like, maybe we should do something about containing him. During the course of their first meeting, of course, that, you know, obviously leads to a big blow-up fight, because why wouldn't it? Because comics. They destroy most of Tim's bat suit, and he cobbles together another one from prototypes in the Teen Titans tower, and dubs himself Savior. not the least bit pretentious or presumptuous there, Tim. But in any case, Tim has gone all Negan on us and is still in this like kind of kill mode. But what's more interesting to me, and I think interesting to a lot of people, is when you see Tim's future, the world he comes from, the trinity of characters are the leaders of the Justice League, or the Titans of Tomorrow, as they're called. They're using a couple of characters that we haven't seen in this continuity before, being Bart Allen, or we haven't seen him in a while. Bart Allen is the Flash, wearing a yellow Flash uniform, very similar to the Reverse Flash. You've got Cassie, who has grown up and is no longer Wonder Girl, but is Wonder Woman. And Superman is Connor Kent, a character that we have not seen anywhere in this continuity. Much like Wally West, he disappeared with the Flashpoint event. So this is seemingly the return of some long-lost characters to the continuity, though it's not really clear how they fit in just yet. Kelly, have you been reading that story?
I've been reading what's been in the actual Super Sons book. I haven't been reading the other the crossover or the connector books.
Teen Titans and Superman.
I'm planning on trying to get those, but I was, you know, one of those kind of caught me by surprise. I really didn't, you know, realize how good the story was going to be. So.
Yeah, it surprised me too. I was not thinking that this story was going to be as good as it turned out to be. But I was happy that the whole thing is directed, or like written and drawn, or not written and drawn, but at least written by the Superman team of Patrick Gleason and Peter Tomasi.
Yeah.
So at least there's, you know, consistency of quality. That's the Superman team. Of course, Peter Tomasi is also writing Super Sons, and they stepped in to guest write on Teen Titans for a little bit. Now, I've had all sorts of ideas running through my head on this one, but it seems like with each new issue that comes out, it's really tough to talk about it in a way that I guess makes a lot of sense for folks. But Kelly, you're familiar with the concept of hypertime. I would think.
Yeah, I am. I am.
That's one I can just tell people that they need to go and do a Google search on, because it would take far too long to get into. But it's kind of interesting that they brought this concept back for this particular story. It's one that was actually reintroduced in A Lonely Place of Living, because the timeline keeps trying to pull Tim Drake back into the future. So he's having a little trouble holding himself in our time. But I find it really interesting that they keep going back to him, and it does kind of seem like by the time we get to the end of this story, maybe we'll be done with future Tim, or like this version of the future won't be around anymore. But what do you think about them bringing Connor Kent back into the fold? And
do you think he's going to be a permanent player now? Is he going to?
Well, he's something that was mentioned in A Lonely Place of Living. Tim Drake mentioned him there, and the Tim Drake of our time, or at least the current Tim, he had no idea who Connor was, but future Tim was telling him, "Hey, whenever you see Connor, just don't forget to tell him you're sorry." And Tim was like, "Who the hell's Connor?" And at that point, the future Tim was like, "Oh man, I'm not in my timeline, am I? Like, this is really strange." So it seems like maybe we've opened the door to an alternate universe, like another Earth that Connor Kent and Cassie and Bart all inhabit. So it's, mm-hmm. But somehow John is also there because John is responsible for Tim coming back in time in the first place.
Yeah.
So I am very curious as to where all of that is going to wind up going. But it has been, for me, it's been a hugely entertaining story. And of course, it's very focused on the Damian and John relationship, which is the strongest part of, I would think it's probably the strongest part of Rebirth overall, just seeing those two interact and seeing their budding relationship, because it really does feel like I'm seeing the future Superman and the future Batman growing up together. And that's something that I think has a world of potential going forward, so long as everybody sticks with it and we don't accidentally or unfortunately erase them from continuity at any point. As DC has unfortunately been wont to do every so often. Shouldn't get rid of your best characters.
No.
So, but they tend to do that occasionally. But anyway, the Super Sons of Tomorrow is one that I'm going to highly recommend. And Kelly, I hope you do go and get all the tie-in issues. Because really, it's just one big issue, which is that's different for a lot of crossovers. Because, you know, at least in my experience, and even in the metal crossovers recently, some of it really hasn't been all that necessary. And some of it doesn't feel like it really ties one to the other. It's like there's too many cooks in the kitchen, I guess, is the syndrome that's going on. Because you've got one team handling one issue, but then the next part is written by, or written and drawn by, a completely different team, so it doesn't necessarily feel like it gels. This is not that case. This is all Tomasi and Gleason. And that being the case, that means all of these issues actually feel like it's one big issue. So one part leads invariably to the next, and it doesn't feel like there's a big break in any of the in the continuity. So if you've been on Superman, or you've just been reading Super Sons, or if you're one of those that's just reading Teen Titans, you gotta go get the rest of the parts. It's a very worthwhile story, and Tomasi and Gleason handle the team dynamic very well, which is something that I absolutely have loved about them as a writing and drawing team. But that being said, I think we've reached a point where we're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back. And when we come back on the other side, we're going to get into the big event that's happening right now, and that would be Doomsday Clock, the big Rebirth follow-up by Geoff Johns and Gary Frank. The Watchmen characters are invading the DC universe proper in a very surprising way. And I got to say that the structure of this story is one that I am absolutely loving. So when we come back on the other side of the break, we're going to get kind of deep on Doomsday Clock. So stay right there. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Here talking about the current events happening in the comic book world as of January 2018. That's weird. It's 2018, man. Kelly, I didn't even ask you at the beginning. How was your new year?
It was quiet.
Same.
It was quiet. Nice and quiet. I mean, you know.
Mine was quiet. Not quite so nice, though. I was recovering from a bout of illness, then we'll just leave it at that to spare everyone the gory details. But did you have a good holiday off? Did you have a good Christmas, Kelly?
Yeah, it was good. It was good.
Now, do you travel around very much for the holidays? You got to go see family?
No, most of my most of my family's gone.
Yeah.
Most of my family is passed on, so it is just my sister and myself and my niece and nephews and my aunt and a cousin of mine that lives here in town. My dad's sister lives here, so okay. Visited with them, visited with friends, went over to Miranda's for a Christmas party and hung out with her and a lot of the other folks, and just then spent time with my sister and stuff. It was nice.
Okay. I was going to ask about your visit to Miranda's. Was it geeky and or sassy?
It was just geeky.
Ah.
Yeah.
Jenny must not have been there then.
No, not for this. This was mainly like it was me and Miranda and Blake and Wally and Dan and Mike and Jessica and Jerry, a couple other folks came by and hung out for a bit. So it was nice just to sit back and socialize and that was basically it. I enjoyed my downtime more than anything else.
Yeah, I tried to enjoy some of mine as well. I actually did manage to get caught up on some trade reading that I've been meaning to get to. I finished off the entire series of Chew, which I only had the one volume left of that to go. Not really all that impressed with the ending, honestly. I got to the end and I was like, huh, well, that's a thing that happened. and just felt
that's very, unfortunate.
It was. It just felt very unsatisfying. Just wasn't what I hoped it would be, and ultimately, just it was a series that started off so well and made a big fan of me to begin with, but then about a volume or two back, it really started to lose it, and then in this final volume, I just it never got it back. It just kind of fell on its face to me. But luckily, I did pick up and finally read two other volumes of a different series. I read Saga Volume 6 and 7 back to back in like a day because I could not put it down. It was just so incredibly well done. And I just got Volume 8 in the mail today, so I'm very excited to continue on with that series. So where Chew has kind of let me down there, Saga never has. Every story is just so well done. I can't get enough of it. So, yeah, at least I followed up a disappointing ending for Chew with two very good volumes of Saga. So I got to highly recommend people go and get on that series. And I kind of kicked myself still for not getting on it when it started, but this is why I love trade collections. So I can just go and read and read and read as much as I want. Get those whole story arcs with no ads and a slightly cheaper price. But yeah. Speaking of high-priced books that do have ads in them, we got one more event to talk to the folks about before we wrap this one up. And I think we got a lot to talk about on this one. And that would be the big DC Comics event Doomsday Clock by Jeff Johns and Gary Frank. It's only got two issues out. The second issue came out just before or right after Christmas, I think. And oh boy, was it a doozy. The first one was the we haven't talked about issue one on this show yet. So as I think most of our listeners are familiar, Doomsday Clock is the follow-up to DC Comics Rebirth, and is also a spiritual, well, not even spiritual, but almost a literal sequel to Watchmen, done in the Jeff Johns style. The events pick up, or at least the first issue picks up on the Watchmen Earth. It's 1992. On the exact date in 1992, when the final issue of Death of Superman was published. And supposedly that does mean something, but we don't know what exactly yet. And it goes forward from there as we see the world peace that Ozymandias crafted has broken down as people find out the truth about that whole situation, about how it was all a grand ruse at the end of Watchmen, that the giant alien creature that supposedly killed millions of people, not even real, or wasn't a thing at all. It was actually a big plan by Ozymandias to get Russia and the United States to cooperate with each other instead of nuking each other into oblivion. And now that the truth has come out, Adrian Veidt is the most wanted man in the world, and Russia and the U.S. are about to lob nukes at each other, but there's no stopping it this time. There's no Dr. Manhattan around, but there is, oddly enough, a Rorschach. And some folks would probably be like, well, that's weird, because we saw Rorschach splattered all over the snow at the end of Watchmen, the end of the first story. So, as it turns out, this guy is not the original Rorschach. He has a similar speaking pattern. He wears pretty much an identical costume. But underneath, as he reveals to one of the characters in the story, his skin is a different color. Everyone knows that Rorschach, the original, was a man named Walter Kovacs, who is a white redhead guy and completely insane. And as it turns out, this new guy, whom Ozymandias identifies by the first name of Reggie in issue two, is a black man, and that's really all we know. That's way we don't really know anything other than that, and that he has a somewhat similar but yet different way of looking at the world from the original Rorschach. Though he does have quite a few of the similar tics and tells. But as this book, as Doomsday Clock picks up, Rorschach has actually been working with Adrian Veidt behind the scenes. Adrian has gone into hiding and has commandeered the old owl ship, the Archimedes, Archie, if you will, that Night Owl used to use, and has been rejiggering it to traverse into the multiverse because he believes that that's where Dr. Manhattan has gone. His whole mission is that if he can get Dr. Manhattan to come back to this Earth, he can convince him to save it and keep people from destroying each other. And he's one of the few people to have figured out what Dr. Manhattan's powers are. He even knows, and this was actually from the original book, the reason that Dr. Manhattan is blue, because of the electrons escaping his body. It gives him a blue appearance. Now, going forward from there, he's figured out that these electrons leaking leave behind a specific signature, and it's something that he can follow, and he's figured out a way to do this. And with Rorschach's help, he's been able to remain in hiding and to track down and bring in two new characters that we were unfamiliar with up to now because they are Geoff Johns originals. And they might be two of the best characters he's ever created. And these new villains called Mime and the Marionette, a husband-wife team, one of whom, Mime, looks not too unlike Superman, honestly. And Marionette, a female character who has a very Harley Quinn-esque bit of quality to her. Well, they're a husband and wife criminal team. They have their gimmicks are a marionette and a mime. Mime doesn't speak. And he uses what could be, I guess, invisible weapons, which is one of the greatest bits I've ever seen. Yeah. Kelly, what'd you think about that? Seeing Mime like going for like an invisible gun of all things.
Yeah. I like the characters. I think like you, they're pretty neat. You know, they've got some they got some quirks to them, so it'll be interesting to see how they play out.
I find Mime and Marionette incredibly entertaining. And I hope they stick around for a long, long time. But the whole deal is the reason that they were brought in the first place is because, as revealed in issue 2, they are former villains that Dr. Manhattan actually has a connection with. Because there was a bank robbery that they conducted together. And it was going south pretty fast because it seems that they were robbing a bank that was used by very rich folks and like high up government officials. So of course, Dr. Manhattan would be called in to deal with supervillains or people dressed as supervillains. And this is during a time in Dr. Manhattan's life when he's still wearing briefs. He's not fully nude yet. So probably sometime in the like late 70s, maybe early 80s at the latest, I would say, is when that particular scene would take place. And I think that's important, something to keep in mind. But you've also got this encounter, or like this encounter with Marionette and Mime that reveals another very interesting tidbit, because Dr. Manhattan, as you know, could snap his fingers and kill anybody. And he's about to pull a Rorschach on Mime, but Marionette jumps in front of him and says, "No, if you're going to kill him, you're going to have to kill me too." And Manhattan stops for some reason, but as it turns out, the reason he did is because he could tell that that Marionette was pregnant. And that's been part of their story from the jump, from issue one of Doomsday Clock. Marionette has been trying to find her son. Rorschach claims to know where her son is, though that's starting to feel less and less true. It's just something he was using to manipulate her into helping Ozymandias and himself and whatever their mission was, because that was Ozymandias's plan, was to bring both of them. Now, I do have a theory on that, but I'll get to that in a second. At the end of issue one of Doomsday Clock, they've met up. They've gone to the old underground bunker where Night Owl used to work. And the question was asked, why didn't Ozymandias go and get Sally and Dan and bring them into this? And since they have a personal connection to Dr. Manhattan, but Ozzy's idea was that seeing Sally and Dan together might have the opposite effect. It might trigger John to not want to help them. So he figured he'd go with a moment where he remembered being human. And this moment of not murdering this woman because she was pregnant was like one of the last times that he could really remember Dr. Manhattan still acting like a human being. So that was their plan, and at the beginning of issue two, we see that the bombs are beginning to fall, and one of them goes off in New York just as they're cranking up the modified airship, and off they go into the multiverse. And they land on the primary DC Earth, the DC Earth that we know things to be, following John's supposed trail. And when they land in Gotham City, and according to Geoff Johns and apparently the things that we're seeing in the story here at this point, the events taking place here take place 1 year ahead of time from where all the current DC books are being published. So this is all a bit in the future, so we're hearing about events that we don't quite know much about. But much like Watchmen, there is supplemental material placed at the end of each issue. So you get newspaper stories and magazine articles that kind of fill you in on some of these things that have been happening while we've been gone. So in that regard, I actually really appreciate the structure of this story being much more Watchmen-esque than I ever expected it to be. And there are a few other parallels in there as well. Kelly, you've been reading this story. You've read at least the first issue. What do you make of it?
I, like you, I think you've covered pretty much the same amount of. I'm excited for this whole series. It really is the first time in a long time that I'm really kind of looking forward to getting in deep with this story and finding out what's going on. I mean, all of this peaked back during the, you know, button issues of Flash and Batman. So, I mean, I think from, you know, like you said about the new characters and this heading out to try to, you know, find Dr. Manhattan. You know, this seems like a just like with my original reading of Watchmen, you might have to go back a few times and read, because there's probably stuff you're going to miss.
Oh, I'd say that's absolutely true. There are parts of this that I've read issue one and issue two. I've read them both twice, and I still feel like I'm finding new stuff. Like there are little things hidden in the art that Gary Frank has thrown in that would be easy to go by the first time you read it. But if you stop and really take it all in, you start to notice this little stuff. And you start to wonder how much of it's important and how much of it is just there for the foreshadowing and for the parallels that this story is drawing with the original Watchmen. Because when we pick up in Gotham City, we see Bruce Wayne undergoing a Rorschach test, which I thought was really interesting. And the Rorschach cards are used later in issue two to show off or to show that these are scenes that we were going to see occur in the actual story. You don't necessarily know what they are, but you see them taking shape. And it's also showing a, as we know, there's protests that happen in the original Watchmen story. Well, there's a protest happening in Gotham City, an anti-Batman protest, much like the 1970s protests that were happening in New York and Watchmen, anti-vigilante protests. Something very similar happening here. A subplot story going on about the metagene or the supermen thesis that says that quite a number of vigilante super people, like enhanced individuals, did not actually occur naturally, but were in fact products of the U.S. government. U.S. government programs creating or funding the creation of certain superpowered individuals, and the two that have come forward to confirm that are the superhero Metamorpho and Dr. Kirk Langstrom, the Man-Bat. And it's, I find that incredibly fascinating. I'm like, okay, this is some trippy stuff. And in the backdrop of all this, Lex Luthor has apparently gone back to his old ways and is trying to buy Wayne Enterprises out from under Bruce Wayne. And is apparently making some strong headway into it, because Bruce is so focused on his Batman activities that he's really let his time at Wayne Enterprises kind of lapse. And the board is kind of questioning whether or not he should be in charge, or whether or not they should even continue on if they're going to get a nice, like, giant sum of money from LexCorp. But that's where we pick up in Gotham City, and we have Ozymandias and Rorschach taking Ozzy's pet kitty, a miniature version of his pet from the original Watchmen story, along this ride with them, because apparently she's the compass, as Ozzy puts it. She's the thing that can help detect the residual energy signature that's coming off of Dr. Manhattan, which would make sense considering their closeness at the end of the original Watchmen. The two being melded together at one point anyway. And this leaves Marionette and Mime handcuffed together inside Archie because they don't trust them not to run off. And as is also revealed in this story, Ozymandias has a giant brain tumor that is apparently getting worse. So there's probably not more than It's not a tumor. It's not a tumor at all. Now, how great would Arnold Schwarzenegger as Ozymandias be?
Yeah, great.
I'm the smartest man in the world. This tumor, it is a tumor. It's the harbinger of my doom. I need Dr. Manhattan to perform an endectomy. I don't know what that is. Just please take this out of my head. Lex Luthor, you look like my tumor.
Well, that, or, you know, you could use the old tool from Total Recall to
there
take
you go.
That tumor out.
Woohoo! when you feel the crunch, you're there.
Where's Greg when you need him?
He could do a better
gold.
Yes, he would be a he could do a better Schwarzenegger than I could, but I'm trying there. But anyway,
yeah.
I would totally buy that. And I actually really dug the first meeting of Lex Luthor and Ozymandias, which does happen in issue 2. After they leave Archie. You have Rorschach and Ozymandias go to a local library to try and learn as much as they can about the Earth they're on. And they even remark on how this the city they've landed in is called Gotham, which is, of course, a a bit of an on the nose name when you really think about it, because that's another name for New York City. So they kind of, you know, giggle a little bit at that, at the absurdity of it. And they even remark that there are certain characters or certain people who exist in real life on this earth that are legit fictional characters on their earth. So they're remarking on this idea that Dr. Manhattan may have created them, or he could be one of them. So the two possibilities that fans have been talking about for a long time addressed right there on the page.
Mm-hmm.
That this could be, it could go either way, that did Dr. Manhattan create this earth, or is he just hiding out on it? Did he give himself a chance to start completely over by being someone else? No answers are found there. These are just the questions presented, but no answers, of course. They identify the two smartest people on the planet, one being Lex Luthor and the other being Bruce Wayne. And they decide that they're going to split up, one going to see one and one seeing the other, to try and convince them to help them. Ozymandias decides to go see Lex Luthor, while Rorschach goes to Wayne Manor. Which leads to one of the subtle funny scenes in the book for me. When Rorschach goes into Wayne Manor, there doesn't seem to be anybody around because it's at night and Batman is off doing his thing. But there on the table is wrapped up a stack of pancakes with a note that says, "Here's your breakfast, sir," and it was signed by Alfred. Well, Rorschach unwraps that, much to his delight, seeing a stack of pancakes there with syrup on them already, and he decides to partake. Rorschach eats Batman's pancakes, and afterwards, he notices the clock, the big grandfather clock in the room, and realizes there's a draft coming through. Using his own detective skills, he finds his way into the Batcave, and even remarks on how the person living here has to be a villain, because only a villain would keep trophies like this. That's trophies from his victims, which is how Rorschach managed to capture so many in his time as a vigilante. He was always able to find the ones who couldn't let go of the past. And on the other end of the spectrum, we see a very diabolical Luthor who has no regard for his employees whatsoever, doing his mad scientist thing in the basement. But then when he goes up to the main levels, he's confronted by Ozymandias, who he berates for not being quite as smart as he thinks he is after he tells him his original scheme of bringing about world peace, which Lex Luthor berates as one of the stupidest plans he's ever heard. And that Ozzy should not be surprised whatsoever that peace didn't last. It was like, that just seemed really dumb. But Oz does lay out the entire story for him, which had to be intriguing to Lex, which is the only reason he allowed him to continue telling it. But the big shock of the issue is when, from out of the shadows, a gunshot rings out inside Lex Luthor's office, barely missing Ozymandias, who manages to get out of the way, but catches Lex Luthor in the side, wounding him greatly. But it's a voice that comes out of that shadow that Ozymandias is just in shock. Everyone is in shock when they see who it is that pulled that trigger, as the comedian steps out from the shadows and reveals himself to be alive and tells Ozzy that he was drunk and not on his game the last time they met, but that this time he was ready for him. And that is where the issue leaves us, as we see that scene coupled with the first meeting of Rorschach and Batman, when Batman confronts him with the line, "You ate my pancakes." And off to in the final panel, we see handcuffs laid off to the side, implying that Mime and Marionette have indeed escaped Archie.
Yeah, like, you think handcuffs is going to stop them.
Oh, but the greatest part was Marionette asking Mime if he brought his lockpick with him. And after some shuffling with his hands, he holds up nothing. But she smiles. because apparently he brought his invisible lockpick. It's so good. But that was issue two of Doomsday Clock, leaving us there in this place where anything is possible at this point, with Comedian now being revealed to be alive, not only alive, but on this earth. How did this happen? We don't know. This is just the kind of insane stuff that is bound to happen in Doomsday Clock. Now, we do know that there's another mystery that's been floating around out there for a little while, and this is just my wild-eyed fan theory that could so easily be way off base, but I think that Geoff Johns is teasing us with the reveal of one of the three Jokers. Because as we know from the end of the Darkseid War, it was revealed to Batman that there's not one, but three Jokers running around. And I think Geoff Johns has subtly told us who the first one is. And it's the son of Marionette and Mime. I think their kid was taken from them very early on, brought to the DC Universe Earth, and he became a Joker. And the reason they've not been able to find any past on him, find like who he is, why he is, or anything, is because he's not of this earth. Of course, there are two others running around. We don't know anything about them, but that's just my theory, that one of the Jokers is the son of Mime and Marionette. Is he the original Joker? Don't know. I just think that he might be one of them. So that's my wild-eyed fan theory for that. But as far as the rest of this goes, oh man, do I have no idea what's happening. But it all feels very Watchmen-esque. You know, like this is a true Watchmen sequel in a way that none of us maybe expected or certainly never knew that we wanted. But the longer it goes, the more it goes, the more intrigued I am to see just exactly what it is Geoff Johns has up his sleeve. And to see Gary Frank drawing more of it, because Gary Frank drawing all of these characters is just tremendous. I love this man's art. It is maybe he may be the best artist at DC Comics right now. And he and Geoff together always seem to give us something amazing. So, Kelly, if you were to venture some ideas, where do you think this could be going? What do you see happening here just from the stuff that we've seen so far in issues 1 and 2?
I don't know. I'm kind of afraid to make any kind of guesses, because it literally could do anything the way that this.
I think that's why we can make guesses, though, because we can.
I mean, this could end up in another crisis.
Very well, good.
You know, I mean, it's been
Crisis Reborn.
Crisis Reborn. I mean, we, you know, that would be my guess. Would be it could open up the door for another type of crisis after this is all said and done. But that I think that's really the only thing I can kind of put my hand on.
Do you think that Dr. Manhattan might actually be a villain at this point?
Possibly. I mean, it's he definitely is a neutral type character, but one that could easily go off the deep end. You know, when you have that much power, I mean, sometimes you can go a little nuts and do bad things. So, I mean, as much as he would like to just kind of do his own thing and not be bothered or what have you. But there is still, you know, like Rorschach bringing Mime and Marionette, there's a sliver of humanity still in him, because he didn't, you know, didn't destroy either one of them, you know.
This, It's just interesting that that he would choose to intervene in certain things, because as we know, the prison that that Mr. Oz was being held in, along with several other characters, was actually of Dr. Manhattan's making, or at least seemingly that's what Oz was suggesting. Whenever he talked about being in that prison, he was like, no, I didn't build this place, I didn't create it. I was just kind of given run of it. But Jor-El himself was also pulled out of the time stream at the moment of Krypton's destruction. So this all, it all reeks of Dr. Manhattan, but we haven't actually seen him do it. Of course, I know that they would, if they were going to reveal Dr. Manhattan, you'd want to wait for the big event.
Yeah.
You'd want to wait for the actual event book to do that. But I've also been toying with the idea that maybe Dr. Manhattan hasn't been the one necessarily, directly responsible for all of this. That there's some, there's something else at play. But Dr. Manhattan certainly is involved. Because we see, if you remember in Rebirth, we actually see the death of Pandora. And she dies in a very similar fashion to how Rorschach died. She's exploded in a flash of blue light. And that strongly suggests Dr. Manhattan. The death of Metron, when he was sitting on his Mobius chair at the end of the Darkseid War. That all looked very much like Dr. Manhattan's doing.
Yeah.
So who really knows what's happening here? The whole thing is, you know, one gigantic but yet really fun mystery. And I think that that's what I love most about this, is intriguing as it all is and is like jaw-droppingly good as the art has been. It's just all these ideas being presented and presented this way without really much bombast, because honestly, there hasn't been much like real like big superheroics or violence in this series at all. It's just been the stuff that's happening, the stuff that's being said, and the revelations about the future of the Earth that that Watchmen took place on. All of that is just so well crafted and presented that you can't help but just keep going with it. Like, they could have Superman never throw a punch in this whole thing, and I if it's still at this quality, I will be fine with it.
Yeah.
It's just so good to read, and the supplemental stuff being included, much like it was in the original Watchmen, is absolutely like must read stuff. Like, I get to the end of that and I'm like, okay, I gotta keep going. I gotta keep reading and finding out, you know, what's going on in this world? What happened to the characters over in the Watchmen world? Like, we didn't find out that, you know, they don't mention it in story, but, you know, Mothman, the last of the original Minutemen, apparently died in the asylum. Because his obituary was printed in one of the supplemental newspaper pages in the back of issue one. But yeah, there's so many places that this could go, and I think that people definitely don't need to sleep on this one. It's a 12-issue maxi series. It is a little pricey. It's $4.99 an issue. So I'm not going to say that it's not expensive, but I'm going to tell you, every issue I feel like I got my money's worth.
Yeah.
But so far, like two issues, I don't mind that I've spent $10 on this already. I would spend another $10 on this easily. And beyond, I will keep spending money on this so long as it's running. And like I said, fingers crossed that Mime and Marionette don't go anywhere at the end of this. I really hope they survive, because what a pair of intriguing new characters he has introduced. And you know, we'll see. And I can't wait to see where it goes. And I'm kind of at a loss for words now to describe any more of it. The only thing I hate is that we have to wait so long between issues.
Yeah.
We got a month wait until issue 3 drops. And I think it's around like issue 4 will come out, and then they'll be taking a break to let Gary Frank get caught up on some of the art, because this a book like this takes a long time to draw.
And yeah, it does.
It's and did you notice that it's also paneled very much like Watchmen?
Mm-hmm.
The panel grids, the 9-panel grid, is very Watchmen-esque. I think the series is going to be studied a bit after it's over. I hope so anyway. Like, I'm definitely going to be pulling out my copy of Watchmen and kind of seeing where all the parallels are and seeing if they didn't do a little panel recreation, because I get the sneaking suspicion that I'm, again, not necessarily catching everything as I go through it.
And
I'm going to need to get in there and really study up a little bit more. But but I'm glad you're enjoying that one too. I am fully on board. I think everybody that's picked it up so far is, and we will be reporting back on more Doomsday Clock stuff as some more issues come out. But with that brings us to the end of another edition of the Sellers Points podcast right here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. And while you guys are surfing around looking for other podcasts to check out, make sure you check out the other stuff on our wonderful feed. Check out at the aforementioned Geek and Sassy podcast. We had the girls on recently to do an episode with us where we looked at back at Batman v Superman and a little bit at Justice League. And you can also check out the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Greg and Nick. They're here every week. Bringing you the news and notes of the day, but also talking about all sorts of different crazy things, and you never know what those two are going to say. So you definitely want to check out every episode. And, of course, you want to get on Todd Weber's Conversation Comics. He and Tim Capel are still doing their Uncanny X-Men read-through. Still one of the most vastly entertaining things that I listen to each and every episode that comes out. And I know that you can't rush quality, so not going to tell them to hurry up and get that new one out, though they should definitely hurry up and get that new one out. And there's plenty of other podcasts that you can check out right here on Place to Be Nation. Make sure you go and listen to all of them. There is something for everybody, be you sports, wrestling, just general entertainment. We have all sorts of stuff here for anyone and everyone. And with that, folks, we don't know exactly what it is it's going to be on our next episode, but we'll surprise you. We'll come back to the new year, and with that, we want to say Happy New Year to everyone. It's the start of 2018. We got a big year coming up. Lots of cool stuff coming down the pipe for comics and for comic book media. So we hope you guys had a great holiday season, that work isn't kicking your ass too hard right now, and that 2018 turns out to be a really great year for all of us. So with that, we will see you guys next time.
Yeah.
Revolution will not be televised.
revolution. We'll be live.